Now, this issue of the Progressive Party was the issue around which the split in the CIO took place in 19 at its Portland convention in Now, the labor skates were in their alliance with the Democratic Party. They were supporting the Democratic Party, although they had great objections to Truman. They were trying every which way, I remember at the time, to find some more acceptable candidate. Truman had played a strike-breaking role during this whole period. In 1946, he had threatened to draft the railway men into the army and then send them back to break the strike of the railway union. And there was a tremendous amount of opposition to Truman in the union movement. However, the Democratic Party nominated Truman, so Truman became their candidate. And the question was of who were they going to support? Truman, the Democratic Party, or the Progressive Party? And this was put point blank to the leaders of the CP-controlled unions. And at the 1948 convention, following a number of previous conferences in which the Stalinists had retreated more and more in their position on the question of Progressive Party support, weakened and undermined their position inside of the union movement so far as the ranks were concerned, they were kicked out of the CIO. Truman out-demagogued Wallace the demagogue. His program was even more radical than Wallace's. He just took the issue away from him. If you remember, during that campaign, it was a very peculiar campaign, he committed himself to a repeal of Taft-Hartley and all kinds of social demands and social reform. He added 10% to everything that Wallace promised, because Wallace and the Wallace Party, the Progressive Party, confined itself to reforms within the existing capitalist structure. And you can always find a slick bourgeois politician when it comes to promising and making promises that can out-promise any amateur. Wallace, I've got to get along. Now, 1949 was the first post-war recession, out of which the country came only when it was plunged into the Korean War, the end of that recession. But more significant, it ushered in the pattern of recessions which has become characteristic of the economy since that time. That is, a recession every 2 or 3 years, out of which we emerge in a new period of prosperity, but never on the level of the past, always with a larger group of unemployed, which have become part of the built-in structural unemployment of the post-war recession period. Now, we'll go briefly into the change in the economic picture, because that's important for an understanding of the development that occurred after 1949. After the Second World War, the United States emerged as the dominant imperialist power in the world. It was the only viable capitalist power in the entire world. The entire world capitalist structure rested on the stability of American capitalism. All the gold in the world flowed into our hoard down here in Fort Knox. And in the part of the turn towards the Cold War was the initiation of the Marshall Plan, the plan to rehabilitate and resuscitate the European economy, which had been shattered in the period of the war and in some countries whose industrial capacity had been destroyed by the bombing attacks back and forth in the wartime period. By 1949, the period of European recovery had been sufficiently advanced so that many of the European nations emerged, began to emerge as competitors of the United States of America on the world market. Countries like Germany, for example, defeated countries whose industry had been shattered, were able, because of building new plant and equipment, to utilize the most advanced technology. And many of the plants they built were superior in productive capacity, in increasing the labor productivity over the advanced plants of the United States. And they began to emerge in Germany, in Japan, in France, in Italy, as competitors for the United States on the world market. At the same time, there was a process of revolutionary development taking place throughout the entire colonial world. First in the East European states, which were converted into workers' states as an outcome of the conflict emerging from the Cold War. Then the independence in India, the Chinese Revolution of 1949, the Indonesian uprising, the uprising of countries in Asia, the beginning of the revolutionary developments in Africa, which created problems for American imperialism, as I say, upon whom the stability of the capitalist world depended, and tended to further narrow down a shrinking world market upon which capitalism, in order to live, must expand, upon which capitalism was dependent. These are some of the background for the policies which emerged, not with the Kennedy administration, but which the Kennedy administration is carrying forward from the previous Eisenhower administration. Another very significant event took place in 1954, which will have its impact on the labor movement, as we will see, was the Supreme Court school desegregation decision, which sparked the beginning of the civil rights struggle, the Freedom Now fight, which has reached its climax in the 1963. 1956, if you remember, was the beginning, was the Montgomery bus boycott movement, in which Martin Luther King emerged as the leader of that group of ministers who were leading that action in Montgomery. From then, the wave of sit-downs and sit-ins, which has now come manifested itself in the North on a much higher level by taking on economic forms and political demands, which are going to make it increasingly difficult to shunt this issue under the rug. In 1955, there took place the merger of the AFL and CIO following the McCarthyite period, an intensive anti-communist drive, which was to serve as a cover for increasing attacks upon the union movement and for threats of additional repressive legislation, which acted as a spur to the merger of the two unions, of the two federations. Now, by 1955, the AFL, which in the period following the war was about equal size with the CIO, was about twice as large as the CIO. That is the specific weight of the two federations had shifted. A whole section of the CIO had been expelled as being communist control. Other sections which had been in the CIO had previously gone over to the AFL, and when the merger took place, it took place on the basis of the AFL emerging as the dominant factor in the merged federation. And the CIO has been, CIO section has been subordinated and been subordinate to the majority, which is ruled by the Meany and his AFL cohorts. One of the things they said that the merged federation would do would be to organize the unorganized. By combining the strength of both of these federations, they said that we would be able to break through this barrier to the expansion of union organization effectively erected by Taft Hartley, and that they would again be able to go forward towards increasing their power and their control over ever larger sections of industry and more political influence because of such increased power. In our analysis at the time, I think I wrote an article in the magazine on the merger, we pointed out a lesson that we had learned from history, not once but many times before, that numbers alone are not decisive, that numbers alone could not solve the problem that the American working class faced, and that unless they effectively abandoned their program of class collaboration, especially on the political field, there could be no reason to expect any success in organizing the unorganized or expanding or even holding their own on the basis of the policy both federations had been following until then. That, I believe, has been absolutely confirmed by the historical development. So much so that one commentator, Paul Jacobs, could be characterized as a left-wing liberal, don't you think? He one of the best liberals, the more honest. I mean this seriously. The man, he has integrity. He is critical of the establishment. And has written some very astute articles on the labor movement and many other subjects. He proposes, because of this experience since the merger, that probably, he says, it would be better if a split along the original lines was initiated in order to break out of this swamp. In which the unions have been stagnating since 1955. He says, and I quote, he says, perhaps unions would have a better chance of taking a significant place in a new bargaining system if the AFL-CIO merger were dissolved. The marriage between these two groups has never been very happy, and whatever advantages it might have had have disappeared. Neither group really wants the alliance any longer, even though they feel unable to free themselves. When the AFL and the CIO were separate entities, each had a special identity, a special behavior as an organization and as an organizer of workers. The Federation has no identity. It is as amorphous and characterless as the dull resolutions perfunctorily discussed and apathetically approved at its conventions. With the loss of identity has come a sharp drop in staff morale, one of the few things that engenders some excitement among union officials of both groups is the thought of a split. Then he goes on to explain why he thinks the split would be a progressive development. He says, if a split did take place within the AFL-CIO, it might be necessary to minimize, if not eliminate, jurisdictional strikes by forcing more unions to merge. How he proposes to do it, he doesn't say. This would be difficult because of the special interests that develop within unions, but perhaps the process could be speeded by the use of legislative authority. Eastland might be of some help to him in this. Competition between unions might pose a problem for employers, since changes in union representation are often accompanied by instability in labor relations and new contract demands. The new union and the employer would have to break themselves in, as it were, and develop new ways of getting along together. But this would not be impossible, and it might even have the advantage of cutting down the mutuality of interest that often develops between union and company officials, sometimes to the detriment of their respective constituencies. In any event, initial instability in union management relations is not too high a price to pay for the advantages that would accrue from a split in separate federation. Now, what would be the advantages? Quote, there would be the political advantages in separate federations. Today, the lobbying of the AFL-CIO is hampered by the contradictory political pressures exerted by the jurisdictional groups within it. The bitterest complaints about labor lobbying often came from labor-supported legislators faced with the conflicting demands made upon them by separate, different groups or groups of unions. There is no reason why separate federations could not join together in their political activities when their mutual interests were identical and lobby separately as they do now, in fact, when their interests are different. Now, it was true. You see, most of these commentators, observers, never did understand what happened or what has happened or what is happening today with the union movement. They never understood that the CIO to the workers who joined that organization was more than a union. It was a social movement. They were not joining a union to get a few pennies more an hour. They were joining a social movement which they felt could lead to a consummation of a fundamental transformation in the society in which they live. Remember, they lived through the company plan period. They lived through the stock market crash. They lived through the Hoovervilles and Hoover's promise of prosperity being around the corner, which we would repeat monthly, and which wasn't satisfying to the empty bellies of the growing army of unemployed. They lived through the big fights to gain union recognition and through the period of the beginning of the social reform legislation of the New Deal, and they saw in the CIO that organization, that institution, that instrumentality that could transform the society and make it one in which never again would they have to go through this trauma of the period from 1929. That was why in the period of the CIOs we discussed before, it was a spontaneous uprising. They had no problem with organizers. Most of the organizers were volunteers. Workers out of the shops, after they got through work, would go around and organize other plants and other workers. They flocked into the CIO because they felt that this movement represented something new, the future, and a better future for themselves and their families. But the movement was diverted and sold out by the fakers, the Communist Party and the Social Democrats, channeled back into the old, narrow concept of business unionism. And today, yes, you have a stagnant union federation, but that's not the worst of it. They never understood this. And so they say, or Jacobs thinks, all you have to do is separate the two. you see, and the CIO would then return to its original, pristine, dynamic, socially conscious, working class movement. No. The labor skates in the CIO are no better than the pot-bellied labor fakers in the AFL. They're both the same. Nothing is going to transform them except a surgical operation. Now, splitting it won't help any more than merging it, unless the split occurred on the basis of the issues that arose in the 30s. Then it was the organization of the workers in the industrial union, mass production industry. Unless the split off would adopt a class struggle program as against the program of collaboration which has led the unions into this stagnant swamp. Outside of that, neither split nor merger is going to help or change the union structure. Now, let's just examine the problem that confronts the organized labor movement today. Number one, as I say, the recurrent pattern of recession. Fixed and ever-growing number of permanently unemployed workers. Workers who have become, as the British say, redundant, squeezed out of the productive process, no longer any place for them in industry. And here I'm speaking about two aspects. One aspect is structural unemployment, and the other, conjunctural. Conjunctural unemployment deals with the unemployment of the ups and downs of the economic cycle, structural unemployment of the fatal flaw in the economic structure, which leads to a fixed and growing army of unemployed. It hits hardest the youth, the women, and the Negroes. In a statement made to the Select Subcommittee on Labor in the House Education and Labor Committee by Ewan Clay, Labor Statistics Commissioner, he says, it is distressing, and I quote, it is distressing that teenagers in May, that is May of 1963, accounted for nearly 30% of the unemployed, and their unemployment rate was close to 20%. The rate of unemployment for adult men has almost returned to what it was before the 1960 recession. This is in the midst of prosperity. You're in a period of prosperity and boom, in case you don't know it. Quote, the rate for teenagers, on the other hand, is even higher than during the recession years of 1958 and 1961. Largely because of this, the overall 5.9% in May 1963 has not returned to the pre-recession levels during the spring of 1960. And this marks the third successive increase in so-called prosperity unemployment. They have a new name. Now it's prosperity unemployment during the post-war period. That is to say, since 1953, there have been three definite cycles in business activity, and in each case, the economy emerged from a recession with a higher rate of unemployment during the recovery expansion phases than during the pre-recession period. In the United States, he says, unemployment has been consistently at a level of 5% or more. Not since the 1930s has unemployment remained this high for so long a period of time. You've got to go back to the 1930s to find a comparable period in which the rate of unemployment, this rate of unemployment, has remained so high. In another address by the Deputy Commissioner of Labor Statistics, Robert J. Myers, entitled Lights and Shadows in the Unemployment Picture. He says, and I quote, "The burden of unemployment is borne very unequally by the various segments of our labor force. Unemployment rates are higher among women than among men, 7.2% as compared with 6.5% in 1961. They are much higher among persons under 20, 15.2%, than among the entire age group from 20 to 64, 6%. With the prospect of 26 million youngsters, 26 million, entering the labor force during the decade of the 60s, this is a fact of particular gravity, and it is. Unemployment, he continues, is heaviest among the unskilled and among those with the least schooling. It is particularly severe among non-whites." He doesn't present his statistics. It would be shocking even to the audience to which he was speaking if he had. "As a broad generalization, the groups that are economically least able to withstand unemployment are those that are most severely affected." $26 million youngsters entering the labor market in the decade of the 60s. Clegg points out the labor force is expected to grow at an average rate of 1.5 million a year between 1965 and 1970. Compared with about 840,000 per year during the 50s. That is almost double the increase of the 50s, 1.5 million per year. This growth will be concentrated to a great extent among young men in their late teens and early 20s. In testimony before the Select Committee on Labor in the House Committee on Education and Labor, Jim Carey of the electrical workers pointed out that in June of this year, when the nation recorded a total employment of 70 million for the first time in history, he says, however, it was in June 1948 when the total employment hit 60 million. Thus, in a period of 15 years, the American economy has created only 10 million jobs. As a result, unemployment is 1.5 million greater than it was 15 years ago. Statistics show that 1.5 million enter the labor force each year, and 1.5 million are displaced by automation, mechanization, and advanced technology. Now, this, of course, according to the theory of Kennedy, could be compensated for by a substantial increase in productivity. What are the figures on this question of productivity? In the Myers report, he says, productivity in the economy as a whole has been rising by 2.5% a year in recent years, 2.5% a year. Now remember, we'll see later that they take this figure of 2.5% a year increase in labor productivity and say that wages must be pegged to this figure. That is, they cannot exceed the increase in labor productivity. It was amusing to read the account of the recent strike in Britain of the construction workers, where the employers of Britain set out their views on why they opposed the demand for a reduction of the work week from 42 to 40 hours and an increase in wages. Because the formula which both the government and the employers impose in Britain is wages should be kept to the size of the increase in labor productivity. So it's not unique with Kennedy. Now he goes on, he says, this seems like a modest figure, but it has important implications for employment and for national income. It means, for example, that each year on the average, the amount of goods and services produced the previous year can be turned out with 1,800,000 fewer workers each year. In a comment on this same problem, the New Republic has some interesting statistics to present, and they quote Manpower Administrator Seymour Wolfbein, who says that increased productivity is proceeding at a rate where in 7 years the United States can produce the total output of 1960 with 22 million fewer workers. The total output of 1960 with 22 million fewer workers. I continue. And that isn't all. For while 22 million present workers will either be in new jobs or unemployed, the labor force will have increased, he says, by an additional 13 million. We shall need 36 million new jobs by 1970, or the unemployment rate will mount to I don't know what. Then the columnist comments. He says, will Kennedy's tax cuts stimulate growth and meet this problem? He says, just to catch up with the job gap already present, the Conference on Economic Progress figures we ought to be booming along now at a growth rate of 8%. Later, perhaps, slackening down to 5%. But what is the actual rate? It is the lowest of any of the three recent economic upturns, 5% during 1961-62, 3.3% from the first quarter 62 to the first quarter of 1963, and only 4.1% seasonally adjusted, quote, during the much heralded quickening of the upturn from fourth quarter 1962 to first quarter 1963. What is the prognosis of the economic development given by the spokesman for the administration? Here is Assistant Secretary of Labor John J. Gilhooly before the American Bar Association. During the next 10 years, the philosophy and psychology and composition of the American trade union movement will undergo, I think, drastic changes. He's a very cautious man. For example, retirements and deaths will change the leadership of the movement. He can't even conceive of any other way in which new union members of a decade hence will have had no personal participation in organizing crusades of the 30s. Moreover, with the exception of the building trades, downward trends have been forecast in manufacturing, mining, and railroads, which have been significant sources of union strength in the past. An increasing proportion of the labor force will be made of younger workers, women employed in services and offices, the white-collar workers who historically have been very difficult to organize and keep organized. One wonders, whether in such circumstances the historic militancy of the trade unions will be molded into a passive conformity, and whether the tradition of assertive and vigorous leadership will yield to a contented and docile movement preoccupied with the glories of the past. If this is not to happen, one wonders what factor will emerge to spark a new militancy, a new zest for organizing the unorganized, a new devotion to the blazing of trails for social and economic progress. Under these circumstances, the question arises, will the Landrum Griffin bill tend further to stifle the activities of the union? It would seem to me, he adds, that unless there is some revitalization in the trade union movement for some purpose that has wide appeal, the increasing encroachment of the government, while undoubtedly accomplishing helpful and proper reforms, may also tend to enervate the vitality of the unions. That's Gilhooly. Let's take a look at this union leadership. You know, in the recent period, I think I remarked before, there's been a whole spate of books and pamphlets and articles, all of which revolve around the matter of the crisis of the trade union movement. This one is called, by Jacobs, is called Old Before Its Time, Collective Bargaining at 28. By the way, you can get this just by writing the Center for the Study of Democratic Institutions, along with a number of other pamphlets they've published on the trade union movement. Very interesting studies. A number of them are distributed free. Some of them are just a nominal cost. You can get the address after the meeting. I'll just read you some of the titles of some of the recent articles. In the Mill and Factory and Employers magazine, Faltering Labor Unions. In Saturday Review of Literature, Labor's Crisis of Public Confidence. In Commentary, Obsolescent Unions. These are some of the titles which indicate the content of these various articles. Now, there has been an accelerated transformation in the American economy, and one that will continue and be further accelerated in the period ahead, and that is advancing technology, automation, mechanization, in which constantly larger and larger number of workers are displaced by the machine, a process taking place since the dawn of capitalist society, but today at an accelerated pace. Unions like, say, the railroad union, in a period of some 10 years, have been reduced from 1,400,000 to 700,000. The mine workers have lost 60% of their membership, just merely through automation, while production increased. Then you can go on down the line, one union after another. Automation is constantly reducing the ranks of the union membership. So that where here you had the strikes for union recognition, in this period, the character of the strikes, the most militant strikes, are for job security. That is the protection of the job, security on the job, a hopeless struggle under the present leadership, but one nevertheless that has imparted the greatest militancy. You saw it in the 116-day steel strike in 1959. What was the issue engendered the greatest amount of militancy in opposition to the company? Was not the original demands by the union, or by the union leadership, but by the threat on the part of the company to alter the work rules. What is it today that drives the most conservative section of the entire union movement? I saw in the New York Times today, George brought a copy, where the leadership of the union has granted all of their locals the right to strike at 12:01 o'clock on Thursday, next Thursday, if the railroad companies post their changes in the working rules. Now, changes in the working rules may not sound like much of a threat, but these changes in the working rules involve the elimination of thousands and tens of thousands of jobs. Feather bedding, they call it. Big campaign against feather bedding. It's estimated 20, 30,000 firemen would be immediately eliminated with just a little change in the working rules. As what would have happened in steel, the longshore strike on the East Coast, the newspaper strike, all of the strikes of the recent period of any significance have been characterized by this as the central issue. Now, what has been the policy of the labor leaders in the face of this development which threatens a consistent and persistent attrition of the union membership? It was best summed up by John L. Lewis in his aphorism, "More and more for fewer and fewer workers." The philosophy of the job trust. More. If you remember Gompers, when I said Gompers' philosophy was summed up in the word more. That's what he stood for. More for the workers, for the labor aristocracy represented in the AFL. The current formula is more for fewer workers. And John L. Lewis was the one who enunciated it. And you have the result in the ghost towns and many of the mining areas of West Virginia, Kentucky, etc. The Bridges Plan on the West Coast is nothing but a variation of the Lewis Plan. The packing house workers, steel union, all of these plans which grant to the employer the right to make technological changes and adjust their working rules to conform with them lead to a narrowing of the union base and the creation of a privileged strata of workers, of organized workers. Seniority now in the unions is the one thing that can arouse the greatest amount of passion among union workers in the plant. Thus, seniority means someone else may get it, the 15-year man or the 20-year man, but I got 25 years, at least I'll stay on the job and get a few more nickels or dimes for it. There is no concept, no social vision, no crusading spirit. Crusading spirit in this gang of senile, spineless, chicken-hearted, and lily-livered swine who are concerned only with maintaining their regular income of $60,000 or $75,000 a year. What has a steel worker got in common with a McDonald who gets $60,000 a year, or a Harrison who gets $75,000 a year, or a Hoffa who gets $75,000 a year? The dwindling of the unions doesn't affect their personal positions of power and privilege. No social vision. Let's look at what the hell they represent. this faltering labor unions remarks, there is little left of the restless evangelism and youthful enthusiasm that marked the labor movement earlier in this century. In fact, the Young Turks who made up the ranks of the labor's leadership in the 1930s have mostly all survived and make up an aging and aged quorum. The average age of the 8-man executive committee of the AFL-CIO is 63 years, the average age. This includes, he adds, the once youthful UAW president, Walter Reuther, who is now 55, and the electrical workers president, James B. Carey, who was 51. And he goes on. The second and third echelons of leadership below the aging tops, whether through lack of training, incentive, or enthusiasm, have little of the dynamism that boosted union membership from 9 million in 1940 to 15 million in 1950. Since that time, the membership in the unions has increased slowly, and in the more recent years, it has been almost static, while the total labor force has been increasing by half to a million workers each year. As a result, the number of union members as a percent of the total labor force has been declining since 1953. There have been all kinds of assumptions as to the cause of the decline. Union apologists maintain that the job of unionization was largely accomplished when autos, rubber, steel, electrical workers, clothing, and the building trades were brought into the union fold. What was left were hard-to-organize industries such as chemicals and petroleum, and the white-collar workers in sales, clerical, professional, and technical occupations. Out of a potential union membership of 20 million, the unions have enrolled only about 2.5 million white-collar workers. And then he has a recipe. Quotes one union official. He says, one union official who has observed at close range the cycle from the 30s through the present suggested at a national meeting of labor officials, he must have made himself very popular with this suggestion, that at the very least there should be compulsory retirement age for union officials. I say amen. They ought to take a statistical survey of each one of them, and as each announces age, they say, that's it, you're retired. That would be have the most salutary effect upon the entire union movement. The leader of the AFL-CIO, 18 million organized workers in this country, George Meany, once boasted before a meeting of the National Association of Manufacturers, submitted his credentials. He said he had never called a strike, he had never organized a strike, and he had never walked a picket line. This is the head of the American Federation of Labor, boasting before the National Association of Manufacturers. This is qualifications for leadership of what it could potentially be the most dynamic and powerful force in the world. Now, there's been considerable liberal disenchantment with the labor movement now, and with good cause. A labor movement of the type of the AFL, that is a job trust outfit, can't inspire much support either among liberals or anyone else except those who are direct beneficiaries in the system. And they all say, why don't they go back to the old crusading days of the CIO, when the liberals could really get their teeth into a social movement which promised reforms. An interesting article in the Nation of January 20, 1962, by Gomberg, Professor Gomberg, from the Wharton School of Finance, in which he says, all of labor's intellectual friends have read Professor Selig Perlman's theory of American job-conscious unionism. All of them were aware how carefully the movement he described eschewed any ideology involving basic social change. My own feeling is that these readers are now shocked to discover that Perlman meant what he wrote. Intellectually, perhaps, they understood, but emotionally, they remain unreconciled to the hard implication of Perlman's analysis. They didn't believe it in their guts, and now they are disillusioned. So today, if they were asked to describe the present membership of the AFL-CIO Executive Council, they may put it in the terms used by Louis Adamek to describe an AFL conclave in his book Dynamite, published by Viking Press in 1929, and he quotes from Louis Adamek. Most of them are prosperous-looking, Babbitt-like, middle-aged or elderly men, well-dressed, carefully barbered, fat-cheeked, doubled and tripled chin, vast-bellied. They are solid citizens, go-getters, full of upper-middle-class, respectable pretensions and ambitions. They play golf and belong to country clubs. What impresses them are such facts that the son of one of their boys is a junior at Princeton, where one of the Rockefeller boys is a student, and according to reports, on good terms with him. On and on. This, he says, is characteristic of the... And he's not far wrong. Now, the policy of the all of these commentators all point out that a basic element in any solution of the problem must be some kind of political action by the union movement different than that conducted in the past. None of them, of course, advocate breaking with the Democratic or Republican Party. None of them advocate the Independent Labor Party, but something different, more dynamic, more social vision. The labor leaders have clung to the coalition with the Democratic Party, despite boots in every part of their anatomy, well-deserved licks by everyone they've supported, including the present John F. Kennedy, co-author of the Kennedy-Landrum-Griffin Act of 1959-1960, an extension of government intervention, control, and restriction upon the labor movement. They no longer even ask or demand of a candidate who they support repeal of Taft-Hartley. They don't even ask anymore that the law be changed, because they fear most of all any request of Congress to introduce changes in labor legislation. They know full well if the Congress made any change, it would only be to tighten the noose around the neck of the labor movement, that they expect nothing good from this gang of cutthroats in Congress who've been doing a job on the labor movement and on the Negro people for many, many years. In January 1960, Cope, that the American, the AFL-CIO political arm, wrote an entire analysis of the effect of Taft-Hartley on the labor movement at the beginning of the very first paragraph. quote, "There is not a single labor management contract anywhere in America that is worth the paper it is written on if there is a Congress or state legislature that wants to weaken or destroy it." No illusions. And they go on to describe what Taft Hartley has done in many areas in the country, especially with the runaway shops that have gone south in order to escape unionization. But you would think that they would wind up with a demand for the repeal. No. We've got to have more grassroots participation in our political campaigns to elect the sons of bitches who are doing the goddamn job. Recently in the New York Times, you know, there was an announcement, you probably, it was in the Chicago Press too, of the businessmen had gotten together to have a political action committee of their own. And to elect good men for office, Democrats or Republicans, good solid citizens. So Louis Hollander, who is the Secretary Treasurer of the New York State AFL-CIO and the chairman of the New York State Committee on Political Education, writes a letter to the Times in which he demurs. The Times hailed this as a very progressive action on the part of politically minded businessmen. And he goes on and he says, quote, he says, "Labor involves itself in politics not for some exclusive special benefit for itself, but for the general good. For it is only by acting for the general good that it can hope to convince the voters, including its own members and the elected lawmakers. But the third party combine, which is now to call itself the Business Industry Political Action Committee, is against every proposal except what will help big business." Period. See? The difference between the Business Industry Political Action Committee and Louis Hollander's COPE is that the Business Political Action Committee recognize that there is a class division in society. And to get what they want, they got to organize politically and go out after it. And you can't do it by using this stupid, idiotic demagogy that you're in the business of politics because it's for the common good. Raskin writes a article, "The Obsolescent Unions and Commentary," in which he also takes up this, has all the criticisms of the transformation of the unions into job trusts, of the inability to solve any of these new problems, which cannot be solved by the local unions anyway. It must be solved on a national scale and through political means. And he goes on then to say how necessary it was to engage in political action. He says, "All of the above problems, that is the demise of the strike, increased mechanization of bargaining, increased bureaucratization of the work process itself, automation and unemployment, will require for even their proximate solution a degree of political commitment American labor that politics become a principal business of unions, not a haphazard adjunct of their narrowly economic purposes." He says, what is the character of these programs that are introduced by the unions every year in Congress? He says, their programs for securing public weal are as lackluster and offered as perfunctorily as those the administration keeps shoveling into the congressional hoppers, looking forward to all the right things, but with no real expectation that anyone is paying any attention to them. Labor stock refrain is that it is for everything the president wants in order to stimulate the economy, only that the presidential bills do not go far enough. Here is the quintessence, the fundamental essence, the alpha and omega of the political policy of the leaders of American labor. Quote, when union leaders come to the White House, they are docile guests. I asked one labor participant in a recent presidential luncheon whether any of the unionists had told Mr. Kennedy he was not doing enough about the unemployed. Oh, he didn't have to, we didn't have to tell him, was the bland reply. He told us. He said the real problem in America was not balancing the fiscal budget, but balancing the human budget. That sounds like Reuther, doesn't it? Doesn't it? I think he plagiarized it from Walter Reuther. Should sue him for it. And with that problem tidily wrapped up, everybody went on a personally guided tour of the White House upstairs. They all left, confirmed in their opinion that the United States had a great president. Is it any wonder now that the mere prospect of the Freedom Now Party sends shivers of apprehension down the spine? Did I say spine? Down what passes for a spine in the gutless wonders leading the labor movement?